Okay, welcome back to Redefine Fitness. I am Kelsey Wells, your host, and I have for you today a guest that I have been wanting on this podcast ever since I heard about her. She is phenomenal, and I cannot wait to get into so many questions that I have for her that I know you guys are going to want to hear about. Let me read to you this introduction because I really don't want to miss anything. Today's incredible guest, and as I said, I am honored that she has taken time out of her very busy schedule to chat with us about topics that I think you're really going to find fascinating and super helpful when it comes to your mental well-being and nutrition, which of course we're big on over here at Redefine Fitness. Without further ado, Dr. Uma Naidoo. Did I say that right, or is it Naidoo?
It's Naidoo. So
Naidoo. Okay, perfect. Naidoo is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, professional chef, trained nutrition specialist, and two-time author. Her most recent book is just launching, so this is super exciting. She founded and directs the first hospital-based nutritional psychiatry service in the U.S., which is huge, which serves as the director of nutritional and lifestyle psychiatry at MassGen, which is obviously also huge, is the director of nutritional psychiatry at MGH Academy, and is also on the faculty at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Uma is considered Harvard's mood food expert, and is also the national bestselling author of her first book, This Is Your Brain on Food, and her second book, which came out in December, Calm Your Mind with Food. This book focuses on nutritional strategies for managing anxiety, which obviously is an area that I personally find so important and fascinating. So I can't wait to get into this conversation. Everyone, please welcome Dr. Uma Naidoo. I wish you could hear them all cheering. I wish this was a live audience. But on their behalf, thank you again for being here. So
thank you so much for this invitation. I appreciate it, Kelsey.
Absolutely. So with Redefine Fitness, we have guests of all different careers and backgrounds, and they all always have one thing in common, and that is that they are women in their power. They are women who are then empowering other women. And with the work that you're doing, I feel like it is both revolutionary and on the cutting edge of our understanding, but also so primal in the basis of it and what you're actually talking about. And I wish that there was more awareness of this. And so obviously I want to do my part to bring you on here and kind of help me spread that.
Thank you.
The questions are going to cover a lot of topics. So for anyone listening who's not familiar, kind of buckle in, but all of this I feel like is pure gold. And before we kind of get into your new book and your first book and your research and all of that, I kind of wanted to take you back and hear more about your upbringing. I always am so fascinated to understand how you became, you know, before the worldly accolades and your successes in your career, and before you came, you know, this woman that we're talking to today. I would love, in so much as you feel comfortable, to hear about your upbringing and more specifically your relationship with your own body image and food and eating in general. How were you raised in that sense, and kind of like what brought you, or what led to the path that is your career today?
Well, how much time do you have?
I mean, honestly, you can take as much time as you have. Like I have blocked out my afternoon, so no stress on my end. But
thank you for that great question. You know, it did actually start my childhood, because it turns out that our impressions of food and our relationship with food, and sometimes even our body image and how we relate to the environment, does stem from childhood. And I didn't realize that I had this amazing opportunity as a child to spend a lot of daytime with my grandparents, because my mom was in medical school. She's now a retired double-boarded physician, you know, one of those brilliant people in the world, and had me when she was in medical school. So in a day, despite all my accolades, I'm actually a preschool dropout because I refused to go. And how my parents allowed me to get away with that, I still don't know.
I love it.
I was like, no, I'd rather spend, you know, I'd rather be at granny, you know, and be at grandma. So, but also I think I was so attracted to that environment because it was so fun, so nurturing. She had a vegetable garden. She prepared meals every day. She worked with spices. I thought it was magic. And so I'd spend time with her during the day, and my parents would pick me up in the evening and help her prepare, you know, do simple things like us, but really little shell peas or, you know, wash the carrots or something like that. But see her really get fresh vegetables, prepare a meal, sit down with me and eat that meal. And for fun, my grandparents would teach me things like yoga and meditation because they had to entertain me, you know. So I feel that I was so blessed with that type of sort of upbringing and cultural background, which at the time I probably as a child didn't appreciate. But at the same time, I had these very strong scientific influences. All of my uncles and aunts were physicians or in training. Some of them were Ayurvedic practitioners. So I had all this influence.
Wow.
And when I landed, you know, when I landed in sort of later in my life, as I went to medical school and I started residency, I realized there were gaps because to me, why would you teach me about prescribing a really heavy duty psychiatric medication, which certainly has saved the lives of many of my patients, but not tell me to address how the person is eating, their lifestyle, and all of that. And I recognized this was a deficit. So as I brought my heritage forward, I realized that there were things I wanted to do more of. And without really knowing what the norm was, I sort of started to ask my patients these questions. And it grew and it developed. And I also had an experience with a patient early on where he was very upset, kind of blaming me for causing his weight gain. But, you know, the online medical record, everything had the data about the fact that he kind of had come in overweight. But an interaction with him taught me how powerful it is to interpret information back to someone. You can't assume that someone knows that information.
Yeah.
And I barely knew it because there's no nutrition education, barely any nutrition education in medical school. And it taught
That's
me the power
wild to
of,
me, you know.
It is, isn't it? I mean, we try to change that. You know, there's a whole lot of work going on and in even, you know, in Washington and that kind of stuff. But still, it's a slow change.
Yeah.
Anyway, that taught me that if you can even interpret someone to interpret information to a patient, a client, a friend, a colleague, whoever it is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And that led me to want to study more and do more. And ultimately, it led to me being able to found and direct the only freestanding nutritional and metabolic psychiatry clinic in the United States, which has existed now for more than a decade at Mass General, and really based with just support from my department chair, about belief in this work to offer these solutions for people. So I told you it was a long story, but you know, that's how it came to be.
Amazing. I mean, thank you. First of all, it sounds so storybook, and I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful upbringing. So thank you for sharing that. I too have very fond memories of my grandmother and being in the kitchen with her, and it wasn't as often as I'd hoped, but I love that. With the program, obviously with this podcast, and I've been very open, you know, I've done a couple episodes on nutrition purely from my personal and professional views and opinions and learnings and story. Mm-hmm. And I can never speak to nutrition, especially here, without acknowledging the prevalence of disordered eating and the reality mm-hmm. of eating disorders in our country, and especially among all people, but women particularly, and the role that diet culture plays in that. And I'm very open with my personal experience. With this program that you have founded, do you work at all with eating disorders or disordered eating, or what actually is that program? Like, what does it look like? Like kind of explain how that goes.
Right. So that's a great question because, you know, eating disorders in terms of, you know, I never forget that first and foremost, I'm a trained psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And I may focus on nutrition and culinary arts and interpreting information, but I'm primarily a psychiatrist. And in mental health, eating disorders can be lethal. So I never forget how serious they are and how important it is to never encourage a diet culture that pushes one to feel you know, that they have to restrict eating or they have to have a disordered relationship with food. In my clinic, what I've had to do is sort of help people and help people get into the right programs to heal their relationship with food. And when that relationship is healed, I've actually had individuals who have been, I would say, stable from eating disorder for a period of time, be able to then interact with food a different way and use it to their advantage for their mental health. Wow. So I think it's important to understand how our diet culture certainly in the US, the eat this, not that mentality, the new superfood every day, the new diet every day, why don't we restrict this food group? Why don't we throw that food group out? It's very harmful. It's very harmful to our psychology. And even though I'm often asked, well, you know, why do you always recommend a certain pattern or this or that? It's actually not that. I try to be flexible with what that person is eating. So if you, for example, are vegetarian, or you, for example, pescatarian, or you maybe prefer just a pure paleo diet, my role is to help you edit that to the best of our ability to be best for your mental health. I'm not there to judge whether you eat seafood or you purely eat a plant-based diet. It's about optimizing that for your mental well-being.
Wow, that's so cool. I mean, I respect that so much. Just, I always kind of warn, like, anyone who tells you that there's one blanket sweeping right way to eat and this diet and it's end all be all the one, I'm like,
never trust that. Cure you.
I can't ever trust that. You know, we're individuals, but thank you so much. Let me kind of defer back to my questions here. I just have so much that I wanted to cover, although I feel like I could just organically talk to you for hours. So with your latest book, which I really want to go here first, because I want to make sure we have adequate time to cover this. So it's something that I am very personally interested in as someone who suffers with anxiety. I have since I was a little girl in various ways, sometimes very extreme ways. And it's titled Calm Your Mind with Food, which I think is beautiful in and of itself, but it focuses on nutritional strategies specifically for anxiety. So tell us like about this. I mean, you know, if someone wasn't familiar with you and did not have any background in psychiatry or nutrition, just like, you know, your average person, kind of break down why they should invest their time into reading this book. And I guess also what it's really about in just very like simple terms, you know?
Sure. So great question. And thank you for asking it. What I discovered during the pandemic was that every single person I interacted with clinically, or even in my personal life or professional life, was suffering with some form of anxiety. This was borne out by the research published in highly credible journals like The Lancet, that anxiety is increased by 25% worldwide.
Wow.
And so I felt as though, given that I work with food, and this is sort of the lane that I've really pioneered and tried to help people with, why not use that as a stepping stone? It might be, maybe you're waiting for a medication appointment. Maybe you're waiting for a telehealth appointment. Maybe you're just at home, but not feeling great and realizing something is wrong. What can I do? You can actually start with food, and it's a lifestyle pattern. So it's a holistic and integrated approach. We're not going to ignore exercise. We're not going to ignore learning a breathwork exercise, but food is really a pillar of how to do this. And that's what led me to focus in on anxiety and the research. But then I wanted to make it a program that was easy, you know, shopping lists. These are recipes you can follow. This is a plan you can follow each day. And if it's too much for you, start with one day.
Yeah.
You know, look at the recipe list, check off things that you enjoy, take one day out of the protocol and try that and try out some recipes. And if you don't cook, use a list to find healthy versions of those foods. It had to be something practical that would appeal to more people than not. Not everyone cooks, you know, not everyone.
Yeah, that's me.
Right, exactly. Not everyone feels that way. But can you put together salad? Can you just have the ingredients ordered, or get together with a friend or family member and get those and just put it together?
Yeah.
So it's moving from a processed version of that food. Because I think what the food and marketing industry do is, when something is identified as healthy, take cauliflower, which has had its moment. I love cauliflower. I mean, purple sprouted broccoli is on the cover of my book. But then it becomes a pizza crust, and it becomes a nugget, and it becomes all these things. And it's not that they are unhealthy. It's just that they are still highly processed.
Yeah.
Now, I wouldn't necessarily want you, Kelsey, to be steaming the cauliflower, ricing the cauliflower, making your own pizza crust sort of work. But let's also understand that because a food is labeled healthy, a processed version of it is not necessarily healthy. Sure. So I think that this is where it becomes really hard. And even little tips about making either simple things, a little bit of meal planning, or starting with where you feel you can in the kitchen. And sometimes finding a buddy that you can pair up with, maybe it's a partner, maybe it's a close friend, maybe it's a parent, that you can start doing that with becomes really helpful, because food is really powerful when it comes to anxiety.
I mean, I love that. So basically the book is not only going to explain how it's powerful in the relation and be educational, but it also comes with tangible tools that you can implement to take action out of what you've learned, which is amazing. So thank you. Something you said really impacted me. I've been very open about some parts of my personal anxiety experience and different tools that I personally use to cope holistically with anxiety. And really, I feel like thrive with anxiety. Yeah. And lots of those things you mentioned, breath work, meditation, exercise, yeah, all of those kinds of things. And I had never, until I came across you and your research, realized the link between food and anxiety could be a positive one. Because in my personal experience, I have very, very severe food allergies. I'm anaphylactically allergic to nuts and peanuts. And so that has been a cause of anxiety since I was a very little girl. It's very scary and something.
It is incredibly scary.
Yeah. So, I've never been diagnosed with OCD because I've never gone to talk to anyone about it. But objectively looking at many different times in my life, I feel like my behaviors were most definitely not normal and quite extreme. And relating to food, the link between my anxiety and food has always been that it's at the root of it so many times. Mm-hmm. Whether it was disordered eating that I was dealing with, which was based in other, issues I was facing, or whether it was diet culture, disordered eating, or whether it was my allergies and just the paranoia and fear that spurs, it feels like a very liberating and exciting thought to me. And I'm sure to many women, just the knowledge that the link between anxiety and food, it doesn't have to be a catalyst for anxiety. It can actually help calm it. It can actually be a tool that I can redirect my thoughts to cook and fuel my body in such a way that it can help me cope with my anxiety. So it makes me a little bit emotional. Like, I think it's such a powerful thing that I had never considered.
Thank you. I'm just saying that because I want to acknowledge first and foremost, when one has a serious allergy like you do, it is frightening. The world is frightening. Peanut allergies and certain nut allergies, or peanut foremost, is the number one thing that we fear the most throughout the country, certainly in the United States. So the fact that you have to navigate the world with trepidation is understandable. And I think actually, whatever else came along with that, I think just to understand that it is so much harder when you're not sure that a cookie or something you're eating with friends or family may be contaminated or prepared in a kitchen with peanuts is very frightening. And I think that I feel like that vigilance is necessary. There's this frightening story in New York recently where someone purchased a cookie and died.
Yeah,
because it was mislabeled. And I think, we can't acknowledge enough that despite all of the issues concerned, things happen. And therefore, that is a part of what we acknowledge when we talk about food for mental well-being. So if we were to take a step back then and think about, we'll have to really manage your environment tightly. And, it could be labeled by a doctor's OCD, maybe not, I'm not sure. But if you have to manage that rigorously, what can we do and what can we include and what can we exclude? And what do we do to make that comfortable for you, whether it's meal planning, meal prep, whether it's navigating the world, whether it's travel? So I think that these are hugely important because, one of the healthy foods, not necessarily peanuts to start with, but the healthy nuts and seeds that contain the short chain omega-3s are something I recommend all the time.
Yeah.
But finding safe options for people who can't have those. Just like I would deal with someone who doesn't eat seafood, you know, and how do you get your omega-3s, right? Yeah. So how would we find the best solutions for you? I think that's so critical for brain health. And also acknowledging for people, if you're struggling on your own, food is actually a way that you can get started. And it's something that you have in control. It's not from the prescription pad. We're not at that point yet, but it's something you can try that can empower you to feeling better. Even the simplest of habits, like what you add to your coffee, what you have in a cocktail, those simple tweaks can actually help to improve anxiety.
Beautiful. And I love this because it's not something that is this huge, audacious, like time-consuming thing, because you as a human being have to eat every single day anyway.
Right.
Like, you have to prepare food for yourself and you have to take time to eat. And so this is, I always look for ways that I can help women shift their life, their relationship with exercise and eating and their bodies to be healthier that aren't going to just add another thing to stress over. Whereas it's like, wow, I already have to get dinner ready every night and feed myself. Right. So if I, it just gives, I think, people a lot of power to know, like, if I'm feeling more anxious, one thing that I can do to help myself while I'm waiting for other help or when I'm just trying to navigate, it's like a simple thing that I can just start with what I'm putting on my plate and what I'm putting in my mouth, and just a beautiful way to not change your habits, but integrate more mindfulness into the where you're already spending time to get a positive outcome. And I think that's amazing.
Thank you. It's very powerful when someone gets it. And it is so empowering and is such a way to find a path forward, irrespective of what the final destination might be.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a medication. I strongly believe in therapy. Psychotherapy is hugely important. But not everyone, in my opinion, needs a medication. Some people do, and it's life-saving. And other people can trial, you know, how they're eating and their lifestyle, even something as simple as hydration, because dehydration causes anxiety, or even something as simple as a breathwork exercise that can help to take you out of that moment of panic. So these things are just hugely important for us to know as tools.
Beautiful. Well, thank you. I mean, I, for one, can't wait to read the book. Okay. So, in your book, you talk a lot about the gut, your immune system, inflammation, metabolism. These are all like very hot topic areas, I feel like, right now, especially gut health and metabolism is always kind of like a buzz thing. I feel like diet culture has kind of hijinxed it in a sense to, you know, push whatever pills or probiotics or just different supplements. And you always wonder, like, what merit do these things have? Like, I've learned to just be so skeptical of anything that's a new thing on trend, right? As far as it comes to our health.
Correct.
So I'd love to start with like gut health, because it is such a huge prevalent topic right now. So like, what role does the gut health play in your mental health and well-being, and what implications does gut health really have? And then kind of a follow-up to that, how and when do you even know if your gut health is off or if you should be worried or, you know, more aware of that?
Right. So, you know, it turns out that, you know, a few years ago, even a couple, well, I suppose I should start with saying the gut-brain connection and gut health is a newer concept in medical science.
Yeah.
Hippocrates, the father of allopathic medicine, alluded to it, but the science, of course, had to follow. And that's really only followed in the last few decades.
Yeah.
But it's burgeoned. And the gut-brain connection has really helped to explain, as one of the mechanisms, the food-mood connection. The gut and brain originate in the exact same cells in the human embryo. They divide apart. They form organs which are, you know, in two separate parts of the body, but they are connected by the vagus nerve, the 10th cranial nerve. But the 10th cranial nerve, the vagus nerve, allows for chemical messages, chemical neurotransmitters, to have bidirectional messaging between the brain and gut and gut and brain. And 90 to 95% of serotonin receptors and the actual serotonin is made in the gut. So it's not the only location, but it's important for us to understand that as we eat, as food is digested, and as the food is interacting with the trillions of microbes in that digestive tract, in that micro But it's also in the same place that things like serotonin are being produced. Wow. So when we start to understand that, it becomes very powerful. But then let's take a step back for a second. Let me ask you, you know, if you ever have a headache and you're a person who takes a headache pill, where is the pain and what do you do? Well, the pain is usually, you know, somewhere in our head. And we don't think about it. We might have such a bad headache and reach out for that headache pill, take a sip of water and swallow it, hope the pain goes away, but we don't think about it. But you're actually swallowing something that's going to your digestive tract that's acting on your neural tissue. Well, that's a powerful example to help unpack the fact that as we eat food, it's a slower and more steady and more complicated process. But as we eat food, it gets digested, but it interacts with the microbes and the the gut microbiome. But over time, it also affects the brain tissue because these systems are all connected. Just like that headache pill helps your headache, food too can have a positive or negative impact. And the gut microbiome is really almost that central system that navigates that for you. Because if you're eating unhealthy food, say that you are really, you know, consuming mostly a fast food diet, then the breakdown products of that fast food diet can be very inflammatory, and your gut is going to become inflamed over time. The bad microbes, the bad guys in the gut microbiome are going to be fed by sugar and unhealthy foods. And over time, that sets up for a condition called dysbiosis. So that gut microbiome is very central as one of the mechanisms that actually helps us understand very simply the food-mood connection.
Wow. So it is very real and very huge. So following up then, when do you, like, you know, I've, with gut health, I haven't researched it a lot, but I've wondered, like, when do you worry about your gut health? You know, like, how do you know, what's like the red flags to watch out for that say like, oh, you have poor gut health and you need to be more aware or take action or, you know?
Sure. So if you're experiencing mental health symptoms that are new, let's start there because that's my focus in nutritional and metabolic health. I would say, you know, if you're experiencing these symptoms, ask yourself, has your diet changed? Have you suddenly started eating ice cream every night? Have you just been ordering fast food at work every day? Ask yourself that question.
Yeah.
But other things could be an increase in anxiety. It could be a low mood. It could be poor sleep, focus, energy, an inability to concentrate. It could be a skin condition. It could be an outbreak of acne. It could be, you know, skin rashes, discomfort. It could also be gastrointestinal symptoms, gas, bloating, diarrhea. Any of those and more could actually suggest that maybe there's something off in your gut. Wow. And what I ask people to do is just take a step back for a second and say, well, what have I been eating? You know, is there something new I've added, a new habit I've kind of honed in on or something that may be less healthy, and that could be driving inflammation in your gut. So it's an important thing to, it's almost like a self-check-in, and we also call it one of the pillars in nutritional psychiatry is body intelligence. So say you are cruising along and you suddenly realize, you know, every day I'm having such difficulty with my afternoon Zoom meetings or my afternoon meetings at work. I need a candy bar. I need another cup of coffee. I need something to get me through. Well, it could also be what you've been eating for lunch or breakfast over time that's kind of disrupting your gut microbiome.
Wow. I love that. So really, there's so many ways that like an unbalanced gut microbiome can manifest, essentially, whether that be any of those number of things you just listed. What, I guess, and I'm sure, obviously, I know that you literally wrote a whole book about it, but to put it more simply, what, like, do you have three, if someone just doesn't know where to start on taking care of their gut health, like what are three things to focus on or three tips to just in general, make sure that you are fostering a healthier gut microbiome?
Great question. So I like to suggest to people that number one, they swap. The first one is swap. So think about whether, you know, during the pandemic, maybe you began eating ice cream every night or having that glass of wine or two glasses of wine. Maybe you stocked up on cookies or candy or something that's less healthy. So swap out that habit that's handling at you. You know it's not the best. You've kind of carried on, but you're trying to improve. Start there. So for ice cream, in my first book called This Is Your Brain on Food, we have a delicious recipe for ice cream made from bananas, and you can even make it a chocolate flavor. So switch out that highly processed, less healthy, highly sugared ice cream with the healthy choice. So first one is swap. The second is eat more. And what I mean by that is there's so many ways to add in healthy foods that you feel nourished and you feel healthy and you don't feel deprived. Because, you know, I never want to say to someone, let's give up this and stop eating that and don't do this. Because those words and the psychology of eating around that is deprivation. And when you feel that way, you cannot sustain it, you know. And so I like to say to people, look, here's a nutritional psychiatry plate. Let's fill it with 50% colorful vegetables and, you know, herbs and spices and lots of leafy greens and things that are delicious and colorful. Let's have, you know, healthy protein of your choice. Could be tofu or chicken, whatever you eat. Healthy fats, avocado, olive oil is your dressing. And then some grains, you know, maybe a small serving of quinoa, whatever grain you prefer. But balance it in a way, because those foods, if they're actual food versus a processed version of that food, you know, is going to be so satiating and so filling that you're going to enjoy it. Yeah. So I want you to eat more, add in, and not feel deprived, right?
This is amazing.
That's an easy way to do it.
I love it. I say these things all the time, so I'm just so happy.
And then the third thing is, I use the word move more, but what I mean is that holistic approach of to do a breathwork exercise, spend time outdoors, go for a walk, go to the gym or whatever it is that helps you get moving. So that third category is almost an integrated approach. For example, spending 10 minutes outdoors in sunlight and daylight provides 80% of your vitamin D naturally. And low vitamin D is associated with both anxiety and depression.
Wow.
So just taking a walk. And after about 10 minutes, I suggest to people put on that sunscreen or sunblock because we want to practice safe sun behavior. But it's important because vitamin D is so key. So it's those types of ideas that I want people to incorporate. For some people, yoga, meditation, a combination of that, exercise, going to the gym, spending time outdoors. But it's all of that because it's not just nutrition. Nutrition is the pillar, but it's all things that are going to help your anxiety.
Man, that's beautiful. Thank you so much. I feel like that's so doable. It's many of the things I always speak to, setting whatever goal, whether it's exercise, nutrition, or anything in your life, from a place of abundance, not I can't do this, I can't have this, but I want more of this, more of this. So I love that.
That's right.
Okay, so this is something that I have been dying to ask you. In my world and in the fitness world in general, there is such a huge focus and trend on macros, right? And essentially it's a diet where you count your macronutrients, your proteins, carbs, and your fats, and you structure percentage-based or gram-based and your total calories, and that's how you eat and you track your macros. And I'm a fitness trainer. I have like a small fitness nutrition specialization certification that I've done, and I've learned a lot about nutrition. And when I first heard about macros, I was about a year into my personal fitness journey, maybe a year and a half. And I, you know, learned about it from a friend, and basically fast forward, I had pretty much realized that I had forgotten. I had strayed away from the small little things that I had use, like the good habits I've used to shift my diet to be like pretty much completely fast food and really processed to much more healthier and eating more vegetables and more micronutrients. And then I shifted into this macro phase. And the next thing I knew, I really felt like I had kind of abandoned my care of micronutrients and eating less processed foods, because I thought, oh, if it fits my macros, it doesn't matter. And for a time it was like, oh, a donut? Oh, what's the difference between bag of Sour Patch Kids and an apple? I have 25 carbs left, so I'm just going to eat the Sour Patch Kids, not the apple. Right. And it's like, this was championed by a lot of people in the fitness industry And while on the one hand, it's like, okay, for some people, like a previous version of me who had a huge fear of bad foods and who would very much restrict and binge and those kind of things, it was freeing to know like, hey, I could eat a candy here and there and it's not the end of the world.
Yes.
And
yes.
Getting over the hard restrictions, like that was very good. But then it's like, I almost skewed too far where I realized, and I've seen in so many people coming to me where they're like, does it actually matter? Because so many people are saying that a Sour Patch Kid and an apple, or like a candy bar and an apple, it's the same thing to your body. It doesn't know. And I'm like, that cannot be true. And obviously, like, I am no doctor, but I would love to ask you, like, to somebody who says, hey, I have 25 carbs, the carbs are the same for a big apple and a pack of sour candy. Like, what would you say to that, you know?
Right. Well, firstly, I think that's a great question. I think it's one of the things that so many of us get tripped up on. I'll share with you one of the cases from one of my books, where I actually had a friend and colleague who was doing Weight Watchers at work. And this is not specific to them, but what I will say is that there was this part of the program at the time that she was doing where you were allowed to eat a certain amount of, say, candy that they prepared, and you could count it for a certain number of points. And again, I want to point out to people, this is less about the diet or the diet plan, but about the principle.
Yes.
Talking here about the food. And so she was really stuck, and she had this kind of plateau. And she kept saying to me, I'm doing everything. I'm eating salad at lunch. I've cut back on this. I'm exercising every day. I've lost all this weight, but now I'm stuck. There's this last 5 pounds I can't get rid of. So I sort of casually said to her, What are you eating? You know, you said you're eating healthy. Yeah. What do you eat? Well, I eat this and this and that, that. And then she said, yeah, then, you know, my treat every day is I have this little box or bag, whatever it was, of you know, the candy that they make. And I was like, okay, so what's in it? And so she showed it to me. And what I realized was that it wasn't that it was unhealthy. It was that for her body, her microbiome, her constitution, it was actually highly sugared. So even though it was very low calories, it was actually a ton of sugar at that point. And her body had gotten used to over this pattern of slowly and safely losing weight, kind of eating and having less sugar. Mm-hmm. So there was something that was happening where this food was preventing her from getting over that hump. So we worked together, and I made some suggestions to her about eating things like just a small cup of fresh berries or frozen berries like blueberries, and a little piece of extra dark chocolate. In other words, switching it out from whatever she had put into her plan. And it speaks to your point exactly, because the apple is not equal to the Sour Patch Kids or whatever the candy is, because the actual ingredients in those are entirely different. The apple comes with pectin, antioxidants, anti-inflammatory compounds, fiber, many nutrients that your body needs. But, you know, the Sour Patch Kids probably come with a lot of sugar and maybe some sodium and some other ingredients. So, you know, it's kind of a processed candy. Mm-hmm. So even if it's 25 calories, it's a very different product. And your body, your microbiome is going to react differently. And that's so important for us to understand just as a principle. While nutrition science is not 100% exact, it's different for every person, we do understand that, here's another example. I was asked to comment on a TikTok craze that was going on a few months ago. People were encouraging others to drink water, and which is great. I want people to be hydrated. Hydration helps depression and anxiety. But it wasn't just plain water. It was encouraging people to drink water, putting in powdered Skittles. There's actually a powder made from Skittles. And so you pour it into your 40-ounce flask of water, and that's what they were drinking. Unfortunately, that offsets the benefits of the hydration because it's loaded with sugar. Mm. So it's exactly what you're speaking to. The calories are not equal. We want to, more of the time, have the whole food. I'm not saying don't have birthday cake on your birthday or some, you know, whatever it is that you come across, but we can always course correct at the next meal. And if we have that in mind that, you know, 8% of the time or, you know, around there, we're trying to eat the whole food versus a processed, ultra-processed version of it. And we are careful about things like the added sugars, refined sugars, high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, unhealthy fats, all of that stuff. We have that in a bunch and we eat them once in a while. We're going to definitely help our mental well-being.
I love that. Would you say there's a difference even still with, and I've found this personally, and I'm wondering if there's any science behind it. So I love sweets. You know, I have a sweet tooth and fruit is my favorite thing in the world, but also I am very careful to not hard restrict myself from having whatever treat if I want it. Right. And I feel passionately about that, but I've realized, for the first time in probably a decade, I started kind of baking and I will bake if I want a treat instead of going out and buying like the most processed thing, which I typically would have done, like a candy bar or, you know, a cupcake that has an ingredients list that's, you know, two paragraphs long. It's like, I will make a dessert from scratch with my son at home. And then I eat, you know, probably the similar amount, but I feel like I feel better. And I'm wondering if it's because there's not all of the chemicals and it's not, even though, yes, it of course still has butter and sugar and whatever, it's more, less, fewer ingredients, less processed. And I feel like since kind of switching my sweets out with more homemade things, even though I'm probably eating about the same amount, I am feeling better. Is there like merit to that?
There's definitely merit to it because when you're making something at home, for one thing, you know what you're putting into your food and you can control the amount.
Which is huge for my allergies as well. So,
That's right. It's huge. Yeah. Exactly. There's less fear. You know that you can feel safe eating it. You're also modeling really healthy behaviors for your child. Just making stuff and knowing what the ingredients are. And wow, these ingredients turn into that product, I think is very powerful as well. I think that, you know, overall, as long as we do that in moderation, so say you are adding, you know, some form of sugar and a lot of refined flours to it and stuff like that, it's still a baked good. But you know what you're putting into it and you're not eating this three meals a day. You're having it as that nice, you know, snack that you're looking forward to, you're eating it in moderation. But most importantly, for someone with allergies, you know what's going into it. And it's a healthier version than the colorants, food dyes, stabilizers, emulsifiers. Research has shown that some of those thickeners used in foods really disrupt the gut microbiome. So I think that doing that for your safety and eating in moderation is also just modeling great behavior for your family and, you know, something you can include in a regular life.
Thank you. And yeah, and I guess that's typically your first tip was to swap things, right? So like if you want to have a treat, if you really want cake, maybe try to bake one instead of just
bake something,
you know?
Yeah. And people do these really cool things. They use things like macerated dates or create applesauce, the homemade applesauce.
Yeah, I've switched that out in like breads and things. It's really
great. So you lessen the amount of processed sugar and you still have something that's sweet. Cinnamon is another great one as a spice. It helps stabilize blood sugar, but it also brings sweetness. Yeah. So it's a great add-in.
Beautiful. Well, thank you. I have so many questions and I know we won't get through them all, but let me kind of bring back to another topic. Let's see. Okay. So this one I also felt was really, I would be remiss if I did not take the opportunity to ask you. You have discussed the link between blood sugar and panic attacks in particular, and I find this very interesting. Can you help explain how diet influences that relationship particularly?
Right. You know, in general, what we understand in mental health is that panic attacks almost come out of the blue. And that's what a lot of people say. It's how it's been described in the literature. But the reality is, if we are eating in a way that is, say, pro-inflammatory, we know that inflammation is an underlying process that actually leads to conditions like depression, anxiety, cognitive disorders, problems with focus more. So if we're eating in a way that is just driving inflammation, then we actually may be setting up for these, you know, these sort of after effects, and we have to be careful about it. So I think that we can't separate out these factors, because how we're eating is definitely impacting the emotional, the sort of emotional health that we have. And I think that it sort of then encourages us to realize that just cleaning up our diet a little bit and improving it will help how we manage it. Now, what I've seen in my practice is that individuals who come in and are having panic attacks and also have a really unbalanced sort of, say, sugar-heavy diet that's laden with a lot of ultra-processed foods, when we start to tweak those things, remembering it's a marathon, not a sprint, and help them to edit their meals and still feel abundant and like they're eating enough, but really almost clean up a little bit of what they're doing, their panic attacks become less frequent.
Wow.
And they will actually notice, I went by this week, I usually am afraid by the time it, comes to Thursday, I know that something's going to come on. And because they worry about it, right? They have these unexpected panic attacks, but then the rest of the time they spend almost feeling worried that they might have that panic attack.
Yeah.
And so the anticipatory anxiety is also bad. But when you start to, one of the things that impacts this is how we clean up our diets. So all I'm saying is it's not the cure, it's not the prescription, but it is one of the things that can help you, like hydration can with calming teas or just pure water that can really help you.
Amazing. I mean, it's so refreshing to hear you speak on these things. I think it's a very powerful message coming from you because, you have people who think that there's a divide between like mental health, like people who are severely struggling with their mental health or with deep depression or very severe anxiety.
Yeah.
And there's people who kind of want to dismiss that things like sleep and hydration and food could help, right? And movement that could help that person. While also there's people over here on this side who think that that's the only thing that could help. And if you're doing those things, then you shouldn't be struggling. And it's like a little bit divisive where it's like, it truly, like you said, modern medicine is miraculous and there's so much a place for that. But also these tools, these more holistic tools, especially the food that we're putting in our body, which literally makes up how our body works, they do have a direct impact. And so for you to pioneer these things in such a scientific and distinct way, I think is so needed and necessary and also so validating. I mean, I've in my hardest times with my own mental health, unfortunately, I was in a place where I felt like if I sought professional help, I'd be a failure. If I took a medication, I'd be a failure. Right. A lot of shame. And I hid a lot of what I was going through and experiencing panic attacks, especially postpartum frequently. I turned to exercise and eating and meditation and movement and these things. And I did see such a huge improvement. And then there's other times in my life where, or I learn more and then I realize, wow, talk therapy, it actually is so powerful, So there's so many tools.
Right.
But I just wanted to thank you for being this very professional voice that it all does go together. And it's not one or the other, right? It's you and doing what works best for you on your path to healing. And that's all I ever try to help people understand,
Well, thank you for saying that. I that's really heartfelt, and it's heartfelt because sometimes when you are a voice of what my team calls, voice of reason in the kind of nutrition and fitness world around just the nutrition component, and just trying to offer well-balanced advice, you get critics will say, oh, well, you only talk about this diet or you only think that. It's not that. I'm not plant-based. I'm not, paleo. I'm not carnivore, whatever it is. I'm just here to focus in on what your mental health issues are. And depending on what you eat, I will help you tweak it based on the nutrition science to improve. It's really not for me to say, give up fish or only eat vegetables, whatever it is, whatever that divide is, or give up a certain food group because, that's what's going to cure you, because each person is different. And my clinical experience has taught me that it has to be sustainable. if I give you 10 things and tell you give up A, B, C, and D today and never look at it, and I rate you if you eat a slice of pizza on Friday, it's not going to help you, because guess what? You're going to crave that pizza more. The following week, and you'll be like, damn, Dr. Naidu, I'm going to have the whole pizza next week. You know, it's just, there's a psychology of eating behind it, you know, and our bodies and our minds don't want to feel deprived, like we're not getting something. So the more times we can find a sense of balance while tweaking one habit at a time or a couple of habits at a time that are going to help is what actually helps my patients sustain these things over time. And it's very gratifying when they write to me like years later and be like, I'm still doing this and I'm great. I haven't needed to increase my medication dose, or my doctor has tapered me off for medication, including diabetes medications. Wow. That's very powerful, you know, because they've sustained it. And some of it is building in the mindfulness practices along with the eating patterns.
Beautiful. I mean, I've certainly seen that in my personal and professional experience as well. So I could not agree more with everything that you've shared. I'm cognizant of the time. I do literally have 10 more questions for you, but I would just want to give you, you know, however much longer you'd like to take. Is there anything that we didn't chat through that you're super passionate about? Or is there any kind of like any message that you want to just kind of end on, and a tip or, you know, a mantra or anything that you want to share or that you think would be helpful for this audience? Mostly women, but obviously everyone's welcome here. So anything you'd like to share to
end? Thank you. Thank you for that offer. I want people to understand that the power, especially for mental health, is at the end of your fork. Because despite everything else that you might be doing or trying, or an appointment you're waiting on, all of that is great. But you can start right now at home, listening to this conversation, by just tweaking one simple thing that maybe is bothering you, a habit that you've held on to since the pandemic and beyond, or that you've begun even last week, that you know is not the best for your body. Food is not only powerful, it's something we do it several times a day, and it is within your control. You don't have to wait on a doctor to give you a prescription. You can actually start to make dietary changes on your own. And I think that that is an incredibly powerful tool to have. And to calm your mind with food, the option that if you say you're not sleeping well, say you don't even recognize that you're feeling anxiety, but it may be manifesting in a different symptom, poor focus, lack of sleep, just feeling fatigue, not being able to get through your day, just try, you know, some dietary changes, look at it, because, you know, if you're listening to this, clearly you care about this and you are thinking about it, and realize that you don't have to be giving up stuff and restrict yourself to actually find your way forward. I think that's extremely helpful and important for people to.
Well, I could not agree more. I'm so grateful for your time today. And we will put all the links, if you're listening, to both of her books and where you can follow Dr. Uma online in the show notes of wherever you're listening to this podcast. So find all of her info there. And again, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for the work that you're doing. I feel like it is of paramount importance, and I'm so excited. So thank you so much. Can't wait to share this chat.
Thank you so much for your great questions and for inviting me. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thank you.